Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast, where we talk to grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Heusendam. My guest today is Icelandic grandmaster Margeir Pettersson, a man of more than one talent, who has been successful in two international careers. Margeir first became a national celebrity in Iceland as a chess player. He won the Icelandic championship twice and had successes abroad as he won tournaments such as the Hastings Premier and various strong opens. He was also a member of the legendary Icelandic national team, the Golden Team, that finished sixth at the Manila Olympiad in 1992. Next, Margeir embarked on a banking career and became internationally known as the owner of the only Icelandic bank that did not collapse in the big Icelandic banking crisis in 2008. In the following years, Margeir switched his activities to Ukraine, where he acquired Bank Lviv, and the city of Lviv in the western part of Ukraine is where he has been living for quite some years now, and where he has opened a chess club that is frequented by well-known Ukrainian grandmasters. In short, there's more than enough to talk about, and I'm very happy that Margeir has accepted my invitation to be on the New in Chess podcast. Margeir is in The Hague for a business meetings, and combined with some leisure, we even watched a football match together. And I'm glad you're back, Margeir. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Good to see you.
So I wanted to start with, let's say, the start of your chess career. I mean, you're very much a child of the 1972 World Championship match between Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky, which took place in Reykjavik, the place where you were living at the time. What was that like? I mean, what are your memories of that match? I mean, you were a kid and got interested in chess then, right?
I was interested before, and I knew the game since, I don't know, well, from age of 5 or 6, but I didn't take it seriously until 1972 when I understood that the match would be in Iceland. And I even went to the Reykjavik international tournament in February, and I saw Leonid Stein, who passed away the last year. So Stein was basically the first grandmaster I laid my eyes on. Yeah. So that was an experience. It's the tournament where Bobby Fischer came, and he saw the game Keen Stein. And then the game was finished, and Fischer asked, did Stein resign? No, they agreed to a draw. And the big master, he just left in a hurry, disgusted, as Keane was winning in the final position.
Yeah. And well, Leonid Stein, he's a Ukrainian legend. He was from Lviv?
Yes, he lived in Lviv most of his years, and actually he lived in a place which is opposite to where I live, just across this. It's a fantastic coincidence.
Yeah. Well, he sadly passed away at a very young age. I mean, his results in international chess, I mean, they were simply incredible. I mean, there must be younger people who have never heard of Leonid Stein. I would say check him out and see what incredible promise was, in fact, well, disappearing when he died way too young. But let's return to 72. So you're this young, ambitious kid who gets, well, whose interest in chess gets a new spark. Did you go to the match?
Yes, I went to two games, game 9 and game 15. Mm-hmm. So the tickets were quite expensive. They cost in today's like equivalent of 30 euro a ticket. So I mean, so I could I was sponsored for two games, and
but then I
managed to get tickets from people who couldn't attend adjourned games.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to several adjourned games.
So the ticket for the normal game was also valid for the
I got the stops from people who couldn't attend.
Uh-huh.
So I attended the adjourned 13th game.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had no idea what was going on.
Uh-huh.
I just tried to hear what the Masters commentator said. And
yeah.
No, it was a fantastic experience, fantastic memory, because all Iceland was dominated by chess.
Mm-hmm.
If you couldn't play chess, you were just not a serious person.
Yeah. Yeah. What I find amazing is that if you think back to those days and what the situation was, I mean, Iceland was a small country. There were lots of things that are, well, very common these days, such as, good television connections, well, let alone internet or whatever. I mean, that all didn't exist. I think that there was television on for one day. Well, once a week there was television in Iceland.
No, that time it was, I think we were already on 6 days a week.
Mm.
No TV on Thursdays.
Ah, just one day. No.
I'm not sure.
And then probably a limited number of hours.
Yeah, absolutely. So everybody watched everything which was on television.
Yeah. And well, this was a big international event. There must have been tremendous excitement about that. That, I mean, of all places, it's Iceland where this match is being played.
Oh yes, in the local population. So everybody was following it.
Mm.
And the moves were actually transmitted through radio.
Mm-hmm.
So if you confused your moves on you lost it.
Uh-huh. You really had to sit glued to the radio if you wanted to follow it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for the games that you didn't attend, did you go to see if you could catch a glimpse of the players or?
I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I, of course, I saw both of them, and the public was all for Spassky,
uh-huh.
most of the public.
Yeah.
Until when everybody figured that Fischer would win, then they turned around, as happens, of course.
Uh-huh. Very practical.
Yeah, because people were offended by Fischer, because he was saying things about our country and.
Mm.
And people thought he wasn't a sportsman like Spassky, mm-hmm. but Spassky was so charming, so so everybody was for him.
Yeah, but was there a chance that you would run into them in the streets, or did they very much stick to the places where they were staying?
I think they were mostly sticking to their places, or they went to special or some special retreats. I don't know, but the. But my father had a stationery shop, and he sold chess sets and chess clocks.
Mm.
And the American delegation, they used to come to him and buy some stuff like chess clocks.
So it created an entirely new industry in Iceland.
Oh yeah. The chess sets and the clocks sold out easily. Yeah.
But also picture postcards. There.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Lots of stuff that
all kinds of memorabilia, all kinds.
So during the match, I mean, your interest in the game grew. I mean, you were not the only one. It was something that was happening all around the globe, but you were there in the epicenter of this match. How did you continue after the match? I mean, what were your feelings after it had finished?
No, I started reading chess books. Like, I became very interested in the Nidor variation, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the 15th game which I attended. And I started remembering opening theory. And then I started reading the books which we had in Icelandic, but they were not so great.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to a junior tournament in the autumn. And I immediately scored second place,
mm-hmm.
out of, I don't know, probably 100 participants. It was,
uh-huh.
it was the, and I started playing in the club, and with the grown-ups, and it was pretty strong tournament. Even sometimes Fredrik Olofsson, he attended. But then there were divisions. There were three divisions, like, because there were probably 50-60 participants every these evenings. And then everybody was smoking very heavily. When I came home from these club nights, my mother would undress me and put all my clothes on the balcony, because the smell was just so intense.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned Fredrik. Well, Fredrik Olofsson, he was the big hero of Icelandic chess at the time. I mean, he was, well, more or less the same age as Fischer, or was he?
No, he was older than Fischer. Yeah. He's born in 35, and I think Bobby was born in 43.
Ah, yeah, so eight years.
Yeah, 8 years. Yeah.
Yeah, but they knew each other well.
Oh yes, absolutely. And yeah. Fredrik, he was communicating with Fischer during the match to try to, you know, to keep him in the match.
Yeah.
Because Fischer almost dropped out.
Yeah.
After the first game.
Yeah. Because that's one of the things that always comes to mind when I think of early Icelandic chess and Fredrik. That, I mean, how different life was then. That the first international tournament that he went to, that he couldn't fly. He had to travel by a fishing trawler.
When he went to Hastings, yes,
yeah.
That's true, yes, but that was in the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were flights, but I guess there weren't a direct to London, and they were very expensive.
Time. Yeah. Did Hastings have a special place in the Icelanders, well, chess heart? I mean, because of him playing there.
Yeah, because of his early victory. Yeah, absolutely.
So when you won Hastings, how did that feel?
Oh, that felt great. So it was, I got interviews everywhere, and it was in the news because it reminded of Fredrik's success. When was it? I guess 20 years earlier.
Because there are...
it was 30 years earlier. Mm. 30 years. I won in 1985, 86. And he won 30 years earlier.
Yeah. Did you also get this kind of hero's welcome? Because I remember this photo of him arriving by plane from Hastings. And
No, nothing. No, but it was a pretty warm welcome. Yeah.
Well, you were part of a very strong generation, and you had this wonderful team. And as I mentioned, in 92, but also in 90. I mean, it was a strong Icelandic team for many, many years, with you and Helgi Olafsson and Johan Hjartarson and John Arnason.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we got fifth place in Dubai in 86.
Mm-hmm.
But then in 92 in Manila, this Olympics were quite a lot stronger, because all the Soviet, there were so many new teams from the collapsed Soviet Union. So instead of one Soviet team, there were 15.
Yeah.
So that was a much tougher. So I would say sixth place there was a better performance than the fifth place in 86.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now we remember that. I think Uzbekistan, that didn't they come third there?
Yeah, right? Yes, in 92. It was a big surprise.
Yeah. But then Uzbekistan was entirely different, fairly different from what it is now, because now they are real Uzbek players. And, and then there were several, Russian players who happened to be living in...
Yeah, who were stationed in Uzbekistan for some business reasons or whatever reasons. So, that's true.
Yeah. So you played many international tournaments. I mean, starting from a young age. What role did chess play in your life then?
No, it was it played a big role. But I just thought when I was like 14 that I started too late. So my ambition was maybe to become an international master and maybe sometimes play for the national team.
Mm-hmm.
But then surprisingly, after I really learned chess at age 12,
mm-hmm.
already at 15, I was in joint first place at the Icelandic National Championship.
Mm-hmm.
But I lost the playoff.
Against?
It was, champion was Björn Thorstensson. He was, mm-hmm. He was a very experienced player. He was mm-hmm. a constant on our national team.
Yeah.
But somehow I lost my form in the summer, and which was a big disappointment.
Mm-hmm. But then, I mean, sharing first, that encouraged you to think of more.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I played in the Reykjavik International in 76, where Nydorf actually played.
Uh-huh.
So I got very well acquainted with him. And,
yeah.
So I talked to him many times after that on Olympics or tournaments.
Did you know him from books before he came?
Of course, course. I mean, the Nydorf variation.
Yeah.
So, of course.
But still, you must have been surprised to meet him in person, because he was such an overwhelming personality.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He was a very nice person to to us. To me, as a teenager, absolutely.
Are there any particular moments that you remember from those meetings with him?
Well, actually, there were two Soviet players. It was Tukhmakov and Antoshin,
mm-hmm.
and Nydorf and Antoshin. They got into a big fight in front of everybody at the playing hall. So, and I think it was for political reason, because they thought that Antoshin was an agent from the KGB to keep an eye on Tukhmakov.
Uh-huh.
That's what they said in those days. It might well have been.
Yeah.
But I actually managed to beat Antoshin. It was the first grandmaster I ever beat during the tournament. So maybe that's why I was in favor by Nydorf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they got into this fight, and then what happened?
Then the arbiters just tried to calm them down, but they were speaking in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting in Russian. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, all these things, they were very sensitive matters for Nydorf.
Yes.
With his, his history in the war and everything.
Yes, and the Soviet domination of his native Poland.
Yeah, yeah. But he was great fun to be around, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. He gave another dimension to the tournament. Absolutely.
I guess you were not the only one who was trying to be in his neighborhood for as much as possible. Right?
Yeah, yeah. He was very popular.
Yeah. Did you play Blitz with him? Did you play?
No. I didn't. I just played this one game, which I lost quite convincingly with Black in 76.
Yeah. But while you were playing chess, you were also studying?
Yeah, I just figured that I figured there was no sense in becoming a professional player. I mean, I was just not strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
I became an international master in 78, but then I had success on and off, and I was improving, and we had actually this strong generation, so we had a very tough competition among ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and that helped us develop.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we were not really working that much together, but you know, you just had to work very hard.
Yeah.
To improve,
mm-hmm.
but I went to university at the age of 19, and I finished in at the age of 24. That was in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a lot of time on legal. I became a lawyer, and
because you studied law.
Law, yes, yeah. And I started working as a lawyer in a bank in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it helped our careers that the competition was so intense,
mm-hmm.
and also in our generation, me and Johan, Helgi and Jon, it was important that we realized you had to study mm-hmm. very hard, and I think we were always very in the forefront in opening theory, mm-hmm. which many other upcoming juniors like from Sweden or they just didn't mm-hmm. they didn't work as hard.
Yeah.
So, and Johan was the youngest of us. He's born in 63, me and Johan in 60, Helgi born in 56. Mm. So I think Johan, he benefited greatly. So he yeah. was the youngest. So immediately when he got up to like 2400 level, 2300, mm. he was fighting with us all the time. He had something mm. to really overcome.
Yeah.
So I think that's might be the explanation why he had the best results of us four.
Yeah.
And in of course he culminated in beating Korsnoy, knocking Korsnoy out in 1988.
In the candidates
matches. Yeah, yeah. 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 Then he really got a hero's welcome.
Yeah.
Deservedly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was with him in the match as a second. So
uh-huh.
So it was quite an adventure.
Yeah. Because I remember that story that I mean just to give an indication of the enthusiasm in Iceland. That there was a performance in the National Theatre and it was interrupted to tell the spectators that Johan yeah. had beaten Korsnoy.
Yeah, yeah. And it was shown live. All the matches were shown live.
Yeah.
On TV, yeah. Which was not easy at that time.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. At DGT, we want to bring people together and help them grow through play by supporting chess and creating innovative, high-quality products for players everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
But I think it's one of the nice things that, I mean, the four of you, you're still very good friends. I mean, it's impossible to meet any one of you guys and not speak about the others because it always automatically happens.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, even now that you're now living in Ukraine, but you still regularly visit Iceland and are in touch with them.
Yeah, I'm in regularly in close touch with them and we go together to senior tournaments.
Yeah.
We've been doing that since 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually Friedrich's initiative
yeah.
that we would participate, and he was. Mm. So it was us four, and then Friedrich on the as a reserve.
Yeah, that that was fantastic. I mean, he as the playing captain,
yeah,
and the Icelandic legend who sadly died not that long ago.
Yeah, he passed away last year at the age of 90. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. We were still you and you started working as a lawyer in a bank. Mm-hmm. You were still playing chess, and then suddenly things in chess didn't go that badly, and it began to feel as if you were turning professional.
I had been working. Actually, I headed a department in the bank, a recovery department, mm-hmm. and it was really very tedious work.
Mm-hmm.
It was really tedious, and I had enough of it after like 3-4 years,
mm-hmm.
and I said, why don't I try my luck in chess? Because I had won Hastings, I had won several other quite strong tournaments, and mm-hmm. so I decided to.
Yeah, you had this string of opens that you won.
I think I won about 25 pretty strong opens
mm-hmm.
during my career and also some close tournaments.
Right? Yeah.
Plus success in Iceland.
Yeah.
So
that gave some encouragement and then... So then you started to play more again.
I actually, the bank was very friendly with me, so they gave me some tasks which I could do together with playing chess but I became really a professional for let's say from 88 until 95 96.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was, yeah, a lot of traveling, and but of course, being a professional chess player is an extremely difficult job.
Yeah,
I really it gives you pleasure when, mm-hmm, everything's okay, but it's really stressful and hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't envy the young the young guys now. It's I can just feel it how it's, and it's getting even harder.
Mm-hmm.
These days,
because of all the preparation.
Of all the data you need to look at, and especially preparation.
Mm-hmm.
It was not so intense in those days. This 35 years ago.
Mm.
You could win with the same idea maybe 2-3 times.
Yeah.
Especially in open tournament. I mean, this is completely out of the question now. You have to.
Yeah.
Innovate all the time.
Yeah.
Just the what was more difficult at that time, it was the adjourned games,
mm-hmm,
which people probably don't, our listeners don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But there was, games were adjourned after 40 moves, and usually they would be played later,
mm-hmm,
like the day after or on the rest day.
Yeah.
So then you had this position in your mind for, yeah, for many days. And
you couldn't feed it to a computer. I mean...
No. It was... So the last tournament I played in with adjournment, it was in Malmö. It was the Siegermann tournament in 93.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last one. And
mm.
But after that, it was just impossible to have adjournment. And even there were no breaks. You just played 40 moves, and then you immediately continued.
Yeah.
And of course there wasn't this 30-second increment.
No.
Yeah.
No, well, that was one of the things that we had to be grateful to Mr. Fischer. One of the many things that he thought up.
Oh yeah. It was I'm not really grateful to him, because I like the old system. It was difficult to change.
Yeah, but what happened after the match? So he wins the match. Was he your chess hero at the time?
Yes, he was. So I basically copied his openings, and mm-hmm, I also copied Friedrich's openings.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were, and because Friedrich, he actually. He worked very hard on his openings, so you could trust something that he played.
Yeah.
And that's why and Fischer, he changed his repertoire. Mm. During the match, he started playing the English opening.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took up the English opening very early on, which was unusual.
Mm. Yeah.
It was like a kind of a eccentric opening.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to push this e-pawn, and d-pawn was accepted, but...
c4 was rare at the time, yes.
Yeah. But you say that you and your friends, you worked very hard on the game, and that these days they even work harder, but they're doing, quite different things. Well, what were you doing? I mean, how did you work on chess?
I had notebooks.
Hmm.
So I for every opening, so I would just write the games into my notebook.
Oh.
So it's for me to memorize something. Mm. It was also in university, in the law, you had to memorize just vast amounts of things. And mm. if I wrote them down, I would remember them.
Uh-huh.
So that's the reason why I use these notebooks.
Mm-hmm.
But they are, it's very extensive, but they are... Mm.
But they were with games that you had played, or things that you had looked at?
What I had looked at. Uh-huh. So mostly they were copied from the Chess Informant or the Shakhmatny Bulletin or Chess in the USSR. And
so if you saw an interesting idea or game in the Informant, you would copy it?
Yes, if I thought I could use it later, I would copy it. So in my notebooks, there are like thousands of games.
Uh-huh.
So, and it was... And it was really hard work. It was, so I had special color for the annotations.
Yeah.
And special color for the novelties and uh-huh. things like that.
Yeah. So works of art.
Yeah, now, yeah, it's quite nice to look at.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember many, let's say, for many years, people, they were still sending handwritten annotations, and particularly some that you got from the provinces in Russia, or they were works of art. I mean, it's just unbelievable how people could write so regularly and beautifully, and drawing diagrams. Did you draw diagrams?
No, I had actually diagrams which I could paste the pieces.
I am. Yeah. So when did law and banking take over again?
So I was a professional for these years. Mm. And I had some successes, but I was not even enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, I won a very strong Lugano tournament in 1989 together with Korsnoy.
Mm-hmm.
And that year I won like six pretty strong opens.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was more up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Reykjavik International, after they became opens, I was usually playing not well,
mm-hmm.
for some reason. And then I won many, really many Gaustal tournaments. One time I won with 8.5 out of 9 against half of the games were against GMs, which was...
Yeah. Well, this was a traditional tournament for many years in Norway.
Yeah, they were organized by my friend Arnold Eikram.
He quite a character.
Oh yeah, he was a great guy, and he laid the foundation to like the rise of Magnus.
Yeah, in fact,
and the rise of Norwegian chess.
Yes, yes.
I mean, Norwegian chess, like in the 80s, they were just. I mean, we would beat them just like nothing. They were they were a walkover for us.
Yeah,
for our national team.
Yeah, and he didn't look very Norwegian. He had a stylish hat, and I mean, that's what I remember.
But he was very serious about this organization. He organized so many tournaments, and so that was the start of the rise of Norwegian chess. And I think the Norwegians should honor him more than they do.
Yeah, there should be an Arnold Eikrem memorial.
Yeah, yeah, there was one, but it hasn't been continued, unfortunately.
That was in Gaustal, I guess.
Yeah, it was in Gaustal, yes.
Yes, yeah. So, you were winning a lot of tournaments, as you say. How were the earnings? I mean, did it make sense?
It was, but I had to write. I was writing aside with that. I was writing for Morgunblaðið in Iceland for... long time, but it was not too bad. I won the tournament in Saint Martin. It was a big tournament in the West Indies. I won it in 91, and that was 10,000 US.
Uh-huh.
That serious money today if you like calculate the inflation. And that, so I had a new flat at the time, and and this basically paid for most of the renovation.
Yeah.
So that was serious money. So, but then you had, and there were appearance fees and all kinds of,
But nevertheless, how did you end up in banking?
So I became very interested. When I was traveling, I was interested in, got interested in the stock market.
Mm.
So I was in the stock market from around 94, 95. And there were privatizations going on in Iceland, and there was a lot of deregulation and progress there. And I understood that Iceland would become like a modern country in the financial way.
Mm.
And I was right about that, and the market developed quite rapidly. And so I founded my investment company in 99. I got a government license for being a broker and asset manager. But up to then I had gone out of chess and was only doing investment activity. So yeah. that was the start.
Yeah. Well, we shouldn't forget that. I mean, besides these other activities, there was also some sort of a disillusionment with chess. I mean, you once told me that, like Bobby Fischer, attracted you into the game.
Uh-huh.
That he also, well, kind of pushed you out of the game.
Well, me and my colleagues, Jorn and Johan, we were also pushed out because the Soviet Union opened up, and then we found out there were so many strong players in the backyards of the USSR. So these opens, they became so difficult.
Yeah, the legendary buses of Russians.
It was really tough. So the tournaments became much tougher.
Yeah,
and appearance fees basically disappeared, and that was a big change. Mm. Also, in 1992, I went to the rematch, Fischer-Spassky.
Yeah,
and I was really shocked to see Fischer.
Yeah,
I hadn't seen him for 20 years.
And you went there as a reporter.
I was a reporter. Yes. Yeah. And Serbia was under sanctions from the United States.
Yeah.
And Fischer decided to play anyway, which started his legal problems with the U.S. And I was honestly I asked him some questions in a press conference, and he answered my questions very politely. But then he got the question, "What do you say about the telegram you got from
the State Department?"
And then he spat on the telegram, and it was just on the press conference.
Yeah,
that was just a complete shock to see Bobby being so kind of rude and and then he was just saying some really he had these conspiracy theories which I difficult to accept and then the New York Times, they published an article, the spitting image of Bobby Fischer. Because there was a popular TV shows, The Spitting Image. At the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I was the first Western GM to be there, and the only one at the press conference. So I was interviewed and quoted all the time by the New York Times. But it was Roger Cohen, one of their senior guys, was there. So.
Yeah, that's a big name.
Yeah, it's a big name in journalism, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But that, I mean, it didn't help you in your enthusiasm for professional chess.
No, I thought it's better to not to get that strong and keep your sanity. No, I really, it was so, I guess from that time I was subconsciously at least on the way out. Honestly, I wanted to just... play for a few years, see what it would take me, and then go back to business. And then I actually, after playing chess, where I was my own boss, I just couldn't go back to a bureaucracy of a bank.
Yeah,
I had to be my own boss.
Yeah,
so that's
why
I started out on my own.
Mm-hmm. You know. And when does an investment company turn into a bank? I mean, how does that go?
So it's a question of capital. You have to put up sufficient capital, and I managed to do that with a couple of friends in 99. So we got basically a full investment management license. Then I got the investment banking license in 2003, and we were doing really well, but I was getting skeptical about the Icelandic environment. It was just going too fast. It developed very fast from 95, and there was no, somehow the big banks, they were privatized, and the new owners they were reckless, honestly. Reckless, and I saw this. I just, it was to me as an insider in the business, it was obvious, and I even So I was in consultations with the National Bank, and I told the National Bank openly what my opinion, that this is just going to end up very badly.
Yeah.
And they anticipated that, and they managed to kind of reduce the damage of the 2008 collapse, mm-hmm. where these three big banks collapsed.
Yeah.
I was trying to get a banking license, but they kind of used their influence to hold me down.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get into the I couldn't even get to be a member of the clearing house, mm-hmm. was owned and dominated by them. So, yeah. But then after the collapse, everything opened up for me, and I got a, and it was actually considered good that they had one clean bank with a license.
Yeah.
So they gave immediately. Immediately after the collapse, they gave MP Bank a full banking license, and we got into the clearinghouse and everything.
Yeah, because that sounded cool. I mean, MP Bank, Margaret Peterson. I mean, did you consider other names, or did you think this?
No, I started with MP Securities because I just thought I would always be quite small, and then it got it got quite a good. It was a good brand.
Yeah.
At the time, and other investment companies, they envied us for the brand. So it. So it was kept even after, I went out of MP Bank in Iceland, and I just went international. Because the bank was split up, and we had new investors. MP Bank needed additional capital, and then they kept the MP Bank name for quite some years, which I was not too fond of it, because everybody thought that I was still there.
When I
wasn't, but anyway, they are doing still very well on my banking license.
Yeah, well, I mean, you couldn't blame them that they wanted to keep your goodwill.
I'm in very good contact with them, but now it's like, now it's a pension fund. So,
But you branched out to the Baltic States, to Ukraine, and now you're in Lviv. Well, you've been there for many years.
Oh yeah.
How did you end up in Ukraine?
It was I got very interested in the Baltic States together with my partners, but then they joined the Europe Union in 2004. Mm-hmm. So instead of increasing the share there in a bank, the share price just went up. So I figured it was just better to sell than to buy more, and look for greener pastures. So so after that I was I've always considered myself to be a entrepreneur in underdeveloped financial markets, which Iceland was in the 80s and even the 90s when I started. And after the Baltics got so developed so fast, I went to Russia, which I absolutely didn't like, and then I went to Ukraine, which was it was totally underdeveloped. It was and actually still is. And then I started making investments, and by chance we found this small bank. It was a really small bank at the time, and we started to develop it. So Bank Lviv, it's named after the city of Lviv, which now everybody know.
Yeah, but
because of the war. But at that time, nobody knew it. So.
Yeah, but you were also in other parts of the country. I mean.
After we got control, I branched out to several other regions, including Kyiv, but fortunately I immediately decided we will not cross the Dnipro River, which turned out to be a very fortunate decision.
Yeah.
Because I just noticed some contrasts and I had information from high diplomats that something might happen.
Yeah.
So basically, we are in West Ukraine. We are one of the leading banks in West Ukraine, and then which is a market of like 12 million people, which is enormous. Well, from somebody from Iceland, where we barely make 400,000. So
yeah.
That's a huge market. So
yeah. Well, but you stress your interest in, well, let's say, developing financial markets. It's also a recipe for finding trouble.
There were huge financial crises in Ukraine in 2009. It came after, so Ukraine was basically just cut out of international financing, which was very difficult, and there was a devaluation. Then there was even a worse devaluation in 2014 when Crimea and the Donetsk, Luhansk regions were attacked, and this was those were difficult times. I can tell you.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, how in 2014, how did I end up here? It's just every day was a new.
I mean, you survived
new rescue mission. Rescue mission. It was
Well, then you survived the Icelandic banking crisis. Then you get this, and then and then suddenly there's a Russian invasion.
And now there's a full scale invasion. A friend of mine in Norway who runs a government fund. He asked me recently, tell me, where are you going next? So we could avoid that place.
But for some reason, I still have the idea that you're very happy to be there.
The country is nice. It's nice people.
Is it pleasant that there's this strong Czech culture that you end up in a
place? Absolutely. That kind of kept me going. So I have great friends in this community, and we try to support them. The bank is a sponsor of tournaments and clubs and also in Iceland I was a sponsor even in there was a trouble for the I sponsored the Reykjavik tournaments. Like in 2010, there was no other sponsor. So I'm saying I'm the sponsor of last resort. There's nobody else to go to. I'll try to help.
Yeah. But in Lviv, I mean, you're good friends with Mikhail Shishin, Belyavsky, Romanishin. I mean, legendary names.
Yes. And also the younger generation. Absolutely.
Yeah. You founded a chess club there where they could meet.
Yeah, it's an informal. You could say it's an informal chess club
or a salon.
We used to play there like once a month, and the Musichuk sisters were playing with us many times. But so many of the younger generation, they left the country, so we have it more rarely now. So lately, it's just the four of us. Me, Adrian Mikhalchisin, Belyavsky, and Romanishin. Then we go out for dinner talk about old
the good old days,
good old times. So I'm really interested in listening to these guys. Like Belyavsky was in the Botanic School, and Adrian was the second of Karpov, and Romanishin, of course, a total legend who has many variations and moves named after him. So I enjoy sitting and listening to the guys.
They've been in teams with so many other legends and many things that, well, for instance, I remember years ago I was talking to Romanishin, and then he told me that he had played this friendly match with Tal.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I had no idea. And then I urged him to write about that. And there's still so many of those, to be uncovered gems in chess history.
He was young at the time, but you can find it through Google.
Well, you can also find it in your own chest.
Yes, that's where I saw it, of course.
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
Well, you've been successful in chess, and you are successful in banking. It's often said that chess qualities, that they help people in other pursuits in life, and it helps you to. No doubt, many people must have said, "Well, as a chess player, you were born to be a banker or whatever." How do you see that yourself?
I don't know. I think there are pluses and minuses for chess players. Mm. And I think many chess players, they think they are like geniuses, and they think they can do everything better than other people. And I think that's quite a common mistake for chess players. You should approach new areas and new tasks with modesty. That's the most important. And, and many chess players, they lack the quality of modesty, I would say.
Yeah. It's this legendary quote from Fischer when he already had serious mental problems. I'm not a chess genius. I'm just a genius, full stop.
You know? Yeah, that would be quite typical. Yes, typical overestimation of one's own qualities. If you have an analytical talent for chess, it doesn't mean that you have analytical talent for every field.
Yeah.
Although we have a lot of examples that chess players had enormous success, like in the scientific field, in economics, and so there are. But I think these are exceptions.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, don't take it for granted.
Yeah. It might happen. It might not happen. It's funny. What was it, 2 days ago when we were watching the football? At some point, you mentioned that there's no grandmaster who has a grandmaster child or son or daughter. It's not something that is hereditary. And maybe it's the same with these talents that you have them for chess, and parts of it, they may be helpful somewhere else, but it's very difficult to find direct links or connections.
Yeah. No, I guess children just see how much time their parents spend on chess, and they say, "I'll do something else."
that's another.
Could be.
Well, now you're still very active as a banker, but you've found back your love for playing chess. You're playing in these senior tournaments with the old friends. How different is it?
It's different. It's like more friendly atmosphere, but the competitive spirit is there. So these tournaments, they're very tough, and the opponents, they are very well prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So where you have these tournaments, if you walk around the hotel, or there's more in the morning, there's nobody there.
Because
everybody's sitting in the rooms preparing.
Yeah.
The same like in the European Individual Championship or the Junior Championship. It's just there's just total quiet because everybody's busy preparing.
Yeah. And you still very much have the ambition to play a good game.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I follow the chess world very closely.
Mm.
So I was out of chess from 98 for 15 years.
Mm.
So I see I missed a lot of things, and I'm reading about those years, and So I have a lot to catch up on.
But you also think that in that respect, you are a winner. You want to have the best results. It's not a pastime. It's a serious thing.
If you play,
I remember you being unhappy about the fighting spirit of the Icelandic team at the Chennai Olympiad, where you went along first as captain, and then you even played a couple of matches. But you were pretty ambitious.
No, the guys, they had fighting spirits, and actually we got the best. I think it was a very good result for Iceland, because we have no chance for fifth and sixth place like my generation.
It was about their division of time.
I was telling them, guys, you mess up a lot of positions in time. So just get a grip on yourself and try to have and have half an hour left after 20 moves. Then you already spent an hour plus the increment. Half an hour, it doesn't seem like too much of a constraint. Nobody on the team, I saw some of them try to do it, but they couldn't.
They were all
back in time pressure and ruined good positions, because they were playing. I was quite happy with her play.
It's so difficult. We've seen it at Norway Chess now, where they have this time control without increment, and they all get in. These are the best players in the world, and they get in extremely bad time trouble, and mess up games because of that.
When we had 2.5 hours for 40 moves, that was the standard time control until the 90s. People got into those crazy time pressures.
They had
1 minute for 20 moves, and they didn't even know how much they had, because you had to look at the clock, and it was very unclear. They were the flag, which people don't actually know now what was the flag. How close your flag was to 12 o'clock. And they were very close in many. And then people didn't know it, and they just banged the clock and hoped for the best, like Walter Brown. He was the most famous. I played with him many times.
Watching him in time trouble, that was a spectacle. It's a pity that there were, probably these days too many things are being photographed and filmed, but for sure in those days many things they should have been filmed, and one of them is Walter Brown in time trouble.
So how
do you prepare these days? Do you prepare like the youngsters do, checking your repertoire and repeating the openings before you go to play?
Of course, I want to get an idea what kind of opponent I'm going to play, what are his favorite openings. I think I prepare the same way like modern players. But of course, you have these strong engines, and I use them just to see if there's a new idea. But then everybody's gone through the most recent games with this. I play more risky chess now than I used to do.
Do you sometimes go over old games?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, I do a lot of that. I'm just like interested in how did Petrosian and Stein handle kind of openings, just to see how their general view was. I like that a lot, and you can there are many ideas like from the 50s, 60s that are now forgotten because the program says -1. They are still absolutely playable. And you can see this new generation, they don't care if they like the position, and if it's -1, but they somehow have a feel for it, they go into it, and that's very interesting to see.
It's funny. You kindly brought me a small present, a small monograph about an opening named after the city where you live, the Lviv Gambit.
Yeah.
And I knew the moves. I didn't know it was the Lviv Gambit. But then the moment you see the moves, then you the first thought is it any good? So it's knight f3, f5, e4.
Yeah.
And is it any good?
I think so. Actually, in the 70s, so I had the Dutch was quite popular opening in Iceland. So so then actually a friend of mine, Bragi Kristjánsson, who was a Dutch fanatic, so he told me you can play knight f3, because after f5, e4 is very tricky. So it was well known even.
Oh, no, it's I'm going to have a it's definitely a very original idea.
So it had a it had a good reputation even then before engines, way before engines.
Oh, it's I like it aesthetically for some reason. It's but okay, that's I'll have a look. I promise. So what are the plans at the moment? I mean, what are your expectations? I mean, you're in a country that is at war. How do you see the coming years? I mean, should we be optimistic, or are you optimistic, or is it still a very dire circumstances?
It's dire. It's dire. So and I think this war is unfortunately going to continue for some years. And I think the Ukrainian population is expecting that. Nobody's believing in that. We don't dream about peace anymore. It's not realistic. The other side is absolutely determined to destroy us as a country, as a nation, and there's nothing to do but fight, and people have no alternative. So this is the expectation. Now it's a bit better because of recent developments, but this could turn around back or turn around back. But but the European Union is helping the country very strongly, basically economically. So at least we have a reasonably stable economy due to this help. So it's so the public is not suffering as much as it would be without that. But it's of course it's miserable, but in Lviv we are so far away from the front that we just feel it by army recruitments, which are very unpopular. So but it's unfortunately gonna go on, and people are trying to live normal lives as possible. This is what everybody's doing.
But in I guess that in every family, that there must be sad stories.
Oh yeah, yes. Everybody knows someone who's perished or is badly wounded.
And well, it's known many chess players, they've left the country. Is there still enough chess activity, or?
Oh yes, yes. Chess remains popular, and people are really trying to do something, and we are helping the chess community just to keep normal things continuing. And you saw that Ukrainian became the individual chess champion of Europe.
Young boy, a very young boy,
and a young girl of 15. She won the European Women International, and she's in a club that we help, and she's a great girl, Natushenko. And so we are hopeful for the absolutely hopeful for the future, and Ukraine were European champions last year. Team champions, and Beliavsky was the team captain. And Mikhail Chishin was the analyst. And they're gonna go again to the Olympics.
And Ponomariov, he played. No, I had him on the podcast then after this victory.
It
was great.
So Kovalenko played. He was the key player, and he was basically coming straight from the front. He had just been dismissed from military service.
And he was cheering up all his teammates.
He just carried the team. He had a fantastic result.
Incredible. Well, it's good to end on a note of hope, Marge, because it's a very sad situation. We can only hope that things will get better at some point.
Yeah, you have to have optimism.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for this talk, just walking through your chess career and your banking career. It's extraordinary, and it's been a pleasure to listen to your stories.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And let's keep meeting in the chess world or otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If this podcast has gotten you in the mood to read a fine chess book or to subscribe to the wonderful New in Chess magazine, then please have a look at our shop on our website, newinchess.com, where you can treat yourself to a great chess read. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next time for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.